Victor Lau, huh? He's the leader of the Saskatchewan Green Party. He and his wife, Heather, own a small business. Victor got into politics to improve health care and protect our environment. He's married with three children. He enjoys reading a wide variety of books and going to the theater. Victor hopes to travel and see more of the world when he retires. And I'll add one more thing, Victor. He's also a member of the Sunday Service Committee. So, Victor, come on up.
Well, thanks a lot. I'm glad we have a good turnout for today's presentation. For those of you out there that don't know what a basic income is, it's been around for a very, very long time. Basically, to summarize, it's the idea of basically giving people money to survive. That's really what it is. There's different ways of coming about creating that money. You know, whether you basically, Alaska has what's called a sovereign fund, and they've collected all this revenue from resources and put it into an investment account, and then they pay out, you know, over a five-year period what has been created through that investment account. Another option is to do it through the general taxation. You bring in, for instance, in the last provincial election, we looked at our provincial budget, which brings in about $9 billion worth of income tax. And basically, you could do it through there, where you basically reallocate that amount to people that are, you know, potentially needy or every citizen. So that's another way of doing it. So there's various ideas. Some people are looking into the future, talking about taking money from copyrights, our natural resources, carbon tax. Some people have brought up the idea of if we're going to have a carbon tax, we should do what's called a carbon tax and fee dividend. So, you know, levy a carbon tax and then pay out a certain portion to every citizen so that those that are basically least able to afford to live can basically live. That's generally generally the idea of a basic income. It's interesting. I've been following this since I heard about this idea in the 1990s, and it really has come a very, very long way. It seems the discussion has come to two points where there's actual talk of not only test trials but actual implementation. And the two models that they're looking at is either universal payout, meaning if we're looking at a nation, every citizen of that nation would get some type of payout, whether it's $1,000 a month, $2,000, $3,000, whatever amount they decide. Or it could be some conservative elements have called a negative income tax, meaning that basically those that are deemed on a certain level below a certain category of income, they would get paid out. So you could still have what's called universal coverage, much like our Medicare system, meaning everybody is covered, but unless your income falls below a certain threshold, you won't get any payout. So there's been it's interesting how the academic world and some of the discussions around that are starting to happen, where which is the fairer system, you could use that term, or which is the more efficient system. And it's really interesting. I've been watching this since the 1990s, so almost 20 some years. Some people on the progressive left have argued that, well, we shouldn't be paying a whatever amount monthly, let's say, to every citizen, because then we'd be paying multimillionaires and potentially even billionaires in our system. And then from the right, you have people that you would think wouldn't want that to happen, but they're saying, yeah, but if you do a means test to say, well, let's say if you have $1 million in assets or in income coming in, you shouldn't be paid, then you'd still basically make a more inefficient system. So it's interesting having you know, different sides argue different points that you would think they wouldn't be on that. You know, that side kind of thing. So I find that really fascinating. More and more around the world, there's just tons of people. Like if they said, if you go to Google statistics, it is one of the most hugely Googled words, right? So the idea of basic income has come a really long way, where more and more people are finding out about it, and I think hopefully supportive. I just want to throw out some statistics. In the last election, when we, as a leader of the Green Party, we ran on this issue of implementation of a guaranteed income, not just a test trial. I personally think it's time somebody do a full implementation and see if it works. So Saskatchewan's population as of October 1st, 2015 was 1,138,879 people. 10% of those people are below the poverty line, which works out to about 113,188 citizens. So we looked at, if we were to implement a guaranteed income of $6,000 per year, that would cost the Treasury $679 billion, roughly. If we were to pay out a more of a livable one, potentially livable, $26,000 per year, that would cost the Treasury $2.94 billion. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, but actually the provincial government has moved our annual spending up from $8 billion, that was under the NDP, to now over $14 billion. So in a short period of time, about two terms, they've managed to add over $6 billion of annual spending. So, you know, $2.94 billion for most of us sounds like a huge number, but in terms of actual provincial treasury, it's not staggering. In fact, our entire social services budget is over $3 billion and continues to grow. Another aspect of it was there are people, and this is where we were hopeful of working with the government that's currently in there, the SAS party. They actually implemented a program called the Saskatchewan Shared Income for the Disabled. And there's about 14,000 residents that are currently being paid about, I think it was between 10 to 12,000 a year. It depends on how, seriously disabled you are. But they were asking for an increase of $250 per month. And we did a quick calculation and promised that, you know, we could easily exceed that and do $500 per month. And that would cost $84 million. So you can see how even for that group, not including all the people in poverty, but that group of 14,000, if we were to increase their monthly check by $500 a month, which they were asking for $250, it would cost the Treasury $84 million. That's almost insignificant. It's a rounding error. You know, when you're talking about billions of dollars coming in every year, it's well doable. Sorry, I'm hoping I won't lose my voice, so we'll keep going here. Just to kind of cover what's happening in Canada, it's very exciting. In the last 2 years, the new minister for the Liberal government, Minister Jean-Yves Duclos, who is the Minister of Families, Children, and Social Development, he started talking about earlier in this year about actually moving toward a basic income idea or implementation of some structure. But he said it wasn't a promise that they'd given, and they have a lot of other areas that they want to work through, like the child benefits program, and they're moving on that. More exciting for me was, alongside that announcement, was the Premier Philippe Couillard in Quebec asked his Minister of Employment and Social Solidarity, Francis Blaise, to begin developing an actual framework for Quebec to move away from welfare and towards a full guaranteed basic income for all of its citizens. So that's in the planning stage, and I think where I'm hopeful is the minister actually was moved from that portfolio and then brought back in, and we don't know if it's a ruse. The Liberal governments there have a real good tendency of putting out real reform and then not following through. I remember Premier Jean Charest talked about electoral reform, and they had a great report. They were going to move toward a proportional system, which probably would have been spread across Canada, and then it never happened. It fizzled. So this could mean, that's what they're trying to do. But Mr. Blaise wrote a book supporting the guaranteed income in his past life before he became a politician. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there if they're serious about implementation. In my last presentation, I talked about how Calgary and Edmonton, both mayors, Mayor Naheed Nenshi and Don Iveson, are in favor of a guaranteed income, and they've been lobbying their provincial government and the national government to say, look, if you guys are talking about just doing a test zone, then pick our two cities. Like, we have no problem with working to implement something there to see if we can eliminate all poverty. Interestingly, PEI, in their last election, I believe it was last year, 2015, all the political leaders, including the Conservatives, were on side with introducing a basic income if they were successful in being elected. The Liberal leader, Wade McLaughlin, became the Premier, and since then we've heard very little about the guaranteed income, though I've been in contact with the Green MLA there, Peter Bevan-Baker, and he continues to raise the issue in their legislature and try and prod them along. Most exciting development, it recently was Ontario. In their recent budget this year, they actually included a plan to implement a guaranteed income trial. It's either to start this fall or more likely early 2017. So that has gone right around the world, that Canada has begun implementation, but actually it's Ontario that's talked about doing a test trial. Manitoba and Saskatchewan, we went through general elections. The Greens raised this idea, if we were successful being elected, of actual implementation. And interestingly enough, Manitoba's Liberal Party, which started having some momentum, but it ended up fizzling out, they were also in favor of implementation of a test trial. And Manitoba is an interesting, province. There in the 1970s, they actually did a test trial in Dauphin, Manitoba, and it worked brilliantly, according to all the research. People were worried about people, you know, not working if they got a guaranteed income, and actually it was a very small amount, less than 10%, and the two groups were kids going back to school to get a higher education, staying in school to get their high school diploma, and the second category was mothers staying at home to raise their kids. So it really didn't mean everybody was basically, you know, going to quit their job and stay at home if they got this guaranteed income. Moving around to some examples around the world, in next couple weeks, 3 weeks away, I guess, Switzerland is going to have a national referendum on introducing a guaranteed income if the vote goes through on June 5th. Interestingly, polls, the group that did some polls, I think working with the newspapers, they actually asked citizens of Switzerland, would you vote in favor of it? Supposedly, 40% are in favor of it, which, you know, it's not enough to actually push it through. But if you think about it, considering this is, an idea that's been, you know, rolling around since the 70s, 40% is just spectacular. It's a huge amount. Yeah, we'll see if it actually turns out to be that high. The second question was really interesting. They asked, if it was successfully pushed through and implemented, would you stop working? Only 2% of respondents said, absolutely, we would just quit our jobs overnight and just take the money and do nothing. So once again, you know, this whole fear that, you know, if we were to implement some kind of guaranteed income, everybody would just, you know, drop out of the workforce. I don't think that's really realistic. What do we have here? The interesting thing I find in Switzerland is the argument for the basic income is coming from citizens, the people that organized the petition. The entire political establishment is arguing that this is a bad idea. Please don't vote for it. Please vote no. And then when asked, well, are you saying we can't afford it? Because that's another argument. We can't afford to pay everyone this income if they're not working. But they actually said, well, no, Switzerland's a very rich country. We can well afford it. What we don't want to see is everyone basically becoming loafers. We don't want to see everyone staying at home and not working and stuff like that. And Finland, who's also doing a massive implementation in 2017, their argument is there's a lot of kind of part-time jobs that are not being filled because they have a generous social welfare system. And what they're trying to do is move toward a permanent guaranteed income scheme where people get paid out the amount tax-free, it's yours to keep, and then they're encouraged to actually take up these jobs that currently aren't being filled. So they're hoping to start in 2017, January, and we'll see where that goes. Around the world as well, Netherlands is doing that, France, and so on. In Switzerland, the amount they're talking about, at least it's thrown out there because it's not a permanent a binding referendum where it tells the government how to implement it, just asks the government to do it. They're looking at $2,600 per month for adults, $600 per month for children. And what happens is if you're below that poverty line, you'll instantly get paid out. If you're actually above it, then as a citizen working above that line, say you're making $40,000 a year, you would get a write-off of $2,600 of that in earned income a month. So that's how they're doing it. And interestingly enough, that seems to be where most of the arguments are starting to happen, where there will be universal coverage, but it won't be kind of what Alaska does, is just a general payout. There's going to be some kind of threshold that you're going to have to meet before you get paid. Another interesting fact is Give Directly. There's a lot of groups in the UK talking about how best to basically help third world countries kind of prosper. And this group, Give Directly, decided to do a program where over a 10-year period, they're going to basically fund citizens in Uganda of small basic income, what would be very small for us, but very good for them. And they're just going to hand it out to the needy citizens, and then they're going to basically monitor what happens over a 10-year test trial. So that the data from that is going to be huge because, there's been kind of test trials around the world 1 to 2 years, but nothing as permanent as this. So I think that's going to be very interesting to see what happens there. What other things can I update you on? I love this part. Italy, who's also going through discussing whether or not to do a guaranteed income, there was a recent Supreme Court decision which went all the way up there, and basically a citizen had stolen a small amount of food, basically a sandwich and I think a drink from a supermarket. And it got into court, and the person was totally impoverished. They looked through the records. The guy has never worked, possibly had mental illness. And somehow it ended up becoming a Supreme Court case because I think the prosecutor wanted to argue either for more time or something. Ended up there, and the Supreme Court, and I believe it was the unanimous decision, ruled that any citizen of Italy stealing for their necessary food needs is deemed to not be a criminal. So they now have legal precedent that you can go into a supermarket and basically take that small amount, as long as it's a reasonable amount of food, for your daily intake, you won't be charged with a crime. So I think that's going to feed into this whole idea of a guaranteed income. Is like, well, if we're saying that they can steal to feed themselves, well, why wouldn't we just say they have a basically an income right to survive? Last point before I show the interesting video I wanted to bring up was, I guess the Republicans in the United States have started talking about how they need more U.S. military spending. And I found out recently watching a film, Michael Moore's, that's playing at the library. Encourage everyone to go see it tonight if you can. The U.S. military spends 60% of its budget on the military, and it's about just under $600 billion, and the Republicans want it over $600 billion. And on my social media site, someone did a quick calculation and said, well, there's about 40 million some Americans in poverty. If you were to divide it out and pay them $12,000 per year, roughly $1,000 per month, that would be less than the $600 billion in military spending. It would be about $480 billion. So once again, staggering numbers, it's sometimes hard to grasp the concept that, we can do this. But if you're in... really, if you're in government circles, yeah, this is normal talk. I mean, they spend billions all the time, and if we're talking about spending $600 billion toward a military apparatus, I think we can well afford to spend $400 billion the other way in terms of ending poverty. So, anyway, I'll play this video, and I'd love to take questions, and hopefully go through more of the Q&A kind of thing. So, I hope you guys will enjoy this. I certainly did. It's a very short video, but it's really, really entertaining. More American statistics, but.
The U.S. Declaration of Independence says we all have the right to life and liberty. But the truth is, you don't have the right to life and liberty unless you can afford it. 1 in 7 Americans lives in poverty. That means they can't afford basic needs like food and shelter. But we have an abundance of resources. We throw away 40% of the food that we produce. And there are 6 vacant homes for each homeless American. The issue is simply, people just don't have access to money. Thanks to globalization and automation, there are not enough jobs for everybody to earn a living. So why don't we just give everybody the money they need to live? Sounds crazy, I know, but in Switzerland, they are actually proposing the idea to give each citizen $2,500 a month for nothing, no strings attached. It's called an unconditional basic income. I think it's a good idea, and here are 10 reasons. Reason number 1, health. Most of what we're all stressed out about is money. That stress leads to poor mental health, which leads to poor physical health, both of which leads to medical bills, which leads to even more stress about money. This survival anxiety can be eliminated with a basic income, so people can focus their mental energy on something other than worrying about money. Imagine what people could accomplish. Number 2, crime will decrease. People are less likely to sell harmful drugs or steal if they don't have to.
I steal only what I can't afford.
That's everything. Reason number 3, it's ethical. Everyone agrees it's messed up for SeaWorld to deprive the whales of food just to get them to do tricks. But we treat humans the same way. It's unethical and unnecessary to force people to do tricks to survive when there's more than enough resources to go around. Reason number 4, productivity. You might be worried that if people didn't have to work to earn money to survive, that things wouldn't get done. But people want to do things. Yes, some people will quit their jobs if they don't have to work them, but it's good for these people to quit their jobs because, let's face it, if they hate their job, they're probably doing a shitty job at it. Them leaving opens up a job for somebody who does want it. Everybody that's working a job is going to be doing so because they choose to. So productivity would increase because people who like what they're doing are better at it and more efficient. When people don't have to work a job, they can spend their time doing something they find meaningful, whether it's volunteering at an animal shelter, teaching, raising their own children, programming some open source software that's gonna change the freaking world. Number 5, fair wages. If people are dependent on a job for survival, they have to take any job available. They can never negotiate a fair wage. Companies will only offer fair wages if people have a choice not to work. Reason number 6, efficiency. Welfare in the U.S. is a complex maze of 126 separate anti-poverty programs. That's 126 separate bureaucratic departments reviewing, rejecting, re-reviewing, then maybe accepting same applicants every other week.
All this for a loaf of bread?
What a waste of time and money. Cut out the bureaucracy and just give the money to everyone. Reason number 7, transparency. One basic income program is so simple and so efficient that it's effectively transparent, so government would have a lot less bureaucracy to hide behind. Reason number 8, it's affordable. To pay each adult U.S. citizen $1,000 a month, it would cost $2.8 trillion a year. The U.S. government spends more than twice that, $6 trillion a year. So it's not a question of whether we can afford it. We have the money. It's just a matter of spending our budget more effectively. I'd much rather my tax dollars go to my own and my fellow citizens' survival rather than pay for the poorest of our nation to be shipped off to another country to throw grenades and get shot at. Reason number 9, the economy. When people have no money, people can't spend money. And when there's no spending, businesses fail and jobs are lost. Basic income provides people with money to spend. That would stimulate the economy, benefiting everybody from business owners to their employees. Reason number 10, it would effectively eliminate poverty. Please leave a comment. I'd love to hear what you think, why or why you don't support it. Let's have a discussion.
So yeah, if anyone has any questions, I'd love to have a discussion on it. Sure. Okay, sounds good. Yeah, almost every day there's stuff coming out indirectly talking about problems that basically a guaranteed income would solve. I think one of the CBC News stories talked about how $81 a month, I think it was given to, mothers with children, and it was just staggering, the health benefits, let alone the social benefits, right? And that was $81 per month. I mean, we're talking about, you know, I think between $1,000 to $3,000. So it's interesting where the direction and the discussion is going, where there's going to be a real base income. And even conservatives realize that it can't be too small, otherwise it really is meaningless. So we're talking about at least $1,000 a month to up to maybe $3,000 a month, which really becomes a livable income. So.
Thanks, Victor. I was actually listening to a CBC documentary on ideas. About the world being automated. Yeah. And this is actually pushing this agenda too as well, because there's so many people losing jobs to automation. Mm-hmm. And but yet countries are still producing products. Yeah. But citizens are getting, you know, poorer and poorer because they're not filling those jobs anymore. So the idea was to have a basic income so that the wealth of the products that are being made gets shared to every citizen.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a really good point. There are venture capitalists and Silicon Valley capitalists. Some of them are basically futurists. They project into the future and look 20, 30, 40, maybe more down the road. And because of automation, they're saying... It's like they see a tsunami coming, and they're saying, and they're taking their billions. And we're not even talking about millions. We're talking about billions of dollars, because these are very wealthy and in some cases very young people. And they're saying, hey guys, wake up. Like, they're lobbying government, but they're also lobbying their own, you know, kind of venture capitalist, you know, investors, and saying, we have to design the world to avoid this tsunami, because if the governments just don't react, they just sit there for 20 years and suddenly, you know, they notice, oh my, 80% of our people are unemployed, and there's like rioting everywhere because nobody can afford food, right? Because it's like moving into the new system. And you're right, one of the statistics I looked at was the second number one employer, I guess, in Canada is in the transportation sector. And whether it's cars or trucks, all of that could be automated. It already has begun. Like, Google, as well as, these large mining trucks, they've already tested it, and they've been using it for years now. So, yeah, it's a big one.
Yeah,
on our city bus, it says one in, out of eight Canadian families goes to bed hungry. Well, apart from Canada, you mentioned Switzerland. Mm-hmm. The Scandinavian countries, I don't think they have basic income, mm-hmm. but they don't seem to have any problems. Can you give us an explanation?
Yeah, I think if you look at the different constitutions of those different countries, like I think you're right, in the Nordic countries, they have a stronger constitutional requirement to treat their citizens better, to protect them from poverty. That's not to say they don't have poverty. Like, say, Switzerland, for instance, they because of the high cost of living and the amount they pay out in, say, social welfare, not guaranteed income, it's still not enough to, quote unquote, you know, cover a real a reasonable way of living. All right, so it's kind of a dilemma where you know, how do you make it so that people have, whether they're working or not, a comfortable living, and what is comfortable to one person may not be comfortable to another. So it's I guess the way to look at the guaranteed income is a way to move away from, well, there's two things, is a move away from means testing. There's arguments more from the conservative side than from the progressive side, but the idea of saying, you know, say these two people up here determining if both came to the welfare office pleading they need, they're in poverty. If I was a social welfare worker, my job would be to determine whether both apply and are needy, or neither of them are needy, or maybe only one. And that leads to kind of real, you know, judgmental almost issues, because sometimes there's a thin line between, well, he's got an extra $100 in the bank, so I'm not gonna give it to you. You use up all your money first, but you don't, so therefore I'm gonna give it to you, right? And a lot of people say that's really leads to that kind of, you know, that judgmental thing. But secondly, it's also the inefficiency of that. By hiring those people to make those determinations, it's basically hiring a very expensive person. And I'm not against hiring social workers. I think they're great people. I know lots. My friend actually got elected into the legislature, and she's a social worker. But I think their talents are almost underutilized by making these judgmental decisions, whereas they can actually be better utilized to actually help people get reemployed, get addiction counseling, financial counseling, so on, to actually move forward in their life, not you know, whether or not they should get, you know, paid out. Kind of thing, so.
I think it's more maybe economic, political mm-hmm. question, but have you, I mean, I don't know if it's part of the process mm-hmm. of charging a bit more on items or products coming from outside of the country mm-hmm. because they've been produced by low-wage citizens, mm-hmm. basically at the poverty line. Yeah. And that was the case also, and now it is changing in China. Mm-hmm. Or you have companies who... Kenyan companies who are producing items from a country where they don't pay their right. workers, yep. and when they come in, it comes under a bylaw which says this particular country doesn't have to pay as many taxes because, mm-hmm. and that is the issue, and that is not part of the psyche currently of charging more and therefore relieving the burden on the country with regard to paying back the people who are minimum wage.
Yeah. Yeah, Bruno, that's a really good question. See, I think my feeling, being a politician, is there's almost three phases. The first phase would be working with citizens, obviously getting a mandate and or support from your general citizenry, say, we want this. We want to make sure every citizen has a guaranteed income so they can live whether they're working or not. Then you move toward implementation. And my feeling on it, whether it's you know, the GST or a special tax, like you're suggesting, you know, taxing, you know, imports versus exports, or carbon tax or whatever, I think we don't want to bind any government's hands. I think when we do the calculation, and, you know, the government bureaucracy can do this, if we were to implement some kind of guaranteed income, we figure out what that amount is, the starting amount, and then you maybe index it to inflation. And then you basically say, let's say it costs $3 billion in Saskatchewan. Well, every budget for the next 4 years of our mandate, we will budget $3 billion plus. moving with inflation to you know, basically pay that out. But we want to basically give governments the flexibility to bring in that $3 billion, I think, from wherever, right? Whether it's resource taxes, income tax, and so on. You can do a special tax. I think that's kind of how Alaska's done it, right? They've basically taken the resource taxes, put it into an investment account, and then through those, you know, earnings, dividends, they pay it out. So there is that possibility, and we can do it. I think that's another way to do it, for sure.
Yes, one of my perennial concerns has always been our excessive military budget. You know, Canada spends about $20 billion, and it's only $600 per person, but when you subtract all the kids and all the elderly and all everybody, people who can't work, it's many, many thousands of dollars per working person. So I think that could be reduced and sent into social programs. But the other aspect, I think, another element of injustice is we don't support children in our society. And I think we should increase the tax deductibility of children so that people who are working and so on can afford to have children, because we don't have any more kids, you know what I mean? And we only get, what's the birth rate, 1.1?
Yeah, very low.
Or 2 per couple or whatever. And so, you know, I mean, we'll be extinct in a few years unless we import all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it seems to me that it would be beneficial to divert some of our economy to the tax deductibility of children, because it seems to me that young people now, I mean, now in my old age, you know, I can afford to have 10 kids. But when I was 25 or 30, and I look at it, the other people just starting out in life, most of them can't afford to have kids. Yeah. But they could, perhaps, if they were getting a higher tax deductibility for the kids that they might have. Anyway, that's just a...
Yeah, it's an interesting argument, because we, you know, in government, you never... I was taught in university anyway, you statistics don't lie, it's the people that use them, right? So you got to really get good, as we know from the past prime minister, we really need scientific data, real data, to make those decisions, right, and determinances. So what you talk about is current, if we can believe the statistic, currently true, Canadians are not having kids for whatever reason. They're just not having kids. So in order to basically employ people in various fields, we're having to, you know, basically, you know, get more and more immigration in, temporary foreign workers, and so on. So it's a tricky question. It leads into this idea of, population, overpopulation, you know, do we encourage it? Quebec, actually, I think it's 6 years ago now, they actually encouraged, they had, I don't think it was a tax cutoff or, you know, subsidy, but it was, I think, a general payout. If you had a kid, they would actually pay you money every month per kid or something like that. So they actually were trying to encourage local Quebec citizens to actually grow their population locally. I don't know if that's still in effect. I would presume so, but, yeah. Anyway, I thought there was one more.
Yeah, thanks for this. It's good to know more about it, and I'm glad to hear that it's of growing interest. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you have any idea how our current provincial government feels about this type of thing.
Yeah, very, very disappointing. I managed to debate the minister of, social services at a disability forum, which then tied into guaranteed income. And this is the weirdest thing. Alberta is going through a massive downturn, as we all know, I think. You know, not only that, but the fire has wiped out billions of dollars worth of, you know, housing and so on. And Saskatchewan, you know, being a smaller kind of, you know, province dependent on oil, is going through the same downturn. And yet both provinces, one ruled by the NDP in Alberta, one ruled by the Conservatives, more or less, in the SAS party, they're not even looking at it. Like, this is a perfect solution. Even if you were to test it, it would be a perfect solution, but they don't want to do it. They say, so in good times, they say, well, you know, we have other priorities. And in bad times, they say, well, we can't afford it, right? And it's like, well, then it's kind of like, for me, the statement came out really from an advocate of guaranteed income in the States. He said, you know, it's kind of funny. We pay nurses to care for people, right, elderly citizens, people in the hospitals. But when we, as caregivers at home, have to take care of our parents or our children that are sick, we don't get paid, right? And it's kind of like a dichotomy. Somehow they just can't see the need for it, right? And I think partly it's because my argument, we don't have working class people in power, That's the, you know, if we had people that really struggled to survive and somehow elected into the parliament and legislature, and we have some, but not as many as we need, I think the programming would change because they would bring that perspective into there. Unfortunately, I'm crossed my fingers for our prime minister. You know, he's a younger guy. Hopefully, he can talk to people of that nature and, you know, get that understanding. So, anyway.
Two more questions.
Okay. Sorry, it is not a question for you. No, it is a question but to all of you. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know if someone of you speaks French, because it is difficult for me to understand.
Okay.
Because he will help someone will help me to understand.
Oh, sure.
Okay, thank you very
much.
Yeah,
we could talk after in the coffee.
Last question. So we will have an opportunity, I hope.
Yeah, the coffee.
Hang around,
yeah, oh, sure. Yeah, the coffee would be great.
So the current system that we have right now, like the social services system, how beneficial is it? Does it like just keep people like in poverty? Is that what it does like right now?
Yeah, pretty much. Many people that don't know anyone in poverty or having used the system, you know, doesn't really understand. My father-in-law's one, right? He's amazing. He's a millionaire farmer, loves farming, conservative, redneck. But we love chatting politics. We both get along, even though we're usually on the opposite side of things. But until his daughter had a disabled child and had to apply because she was at home too much, had to apply for welfare benefits, he had no concept of how brutal it was. They basically said to her, well, you have a vehicle. Sell that. And she says, well, how do I get around then? Well, that's not our problem, they said. Oh, by the way, do you own your own home? Well, I was kind of gifted a home through my father. Well, you'd have to use that up. You'd have to go out and rent. And she's like, I'd have to rent? And they said, yes, you can't have any assets. In fact, you'll have to give us a full accounting of your income tax statements and investments. If you have investments, they said, you won't get a dime. You will have to liquidate everything. And when my father found out, like, I mean, he was already against social welfare being a conservative, right, thinking, well, that's lazy street for many people. But when he found his own daughter couldn't even apply for some basic benefits to keep them going, he just, and these are the reasons why, he just went apoplectic. But try convincing him that guaranteed income is the way to go. He still watches Fox News, and so you know where that kind of goes. But yeah. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, and yeah, I'll be around for coffee if you guys have more questions. So, thank you very much.